I spent the break in India, so if I fall asleep while I'm talking, just somebody needs to come up and kick me. So last time we were talking about quantum strangeness, and I talked about something which is called the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen paradox. Well, there are different ways to think of it, but basically there are scenarios that you can think of in quantum mechanics where things just look very strange from what we're used to seeing. And an example that I used last time was something which we call entangled photons. And the idea is that photons actually have an orientation. You can do it in different ways. They have a polarization, or you can think of it in terms of spin. It's not really important what it is, except just to think of them as being able to be oriented. And it turns out that that you can have them produced by, say, a particle decay into two photons. And when this happens, at the decay, there's a correlation between this characteristic of photons. So, for example, they could be oriented like this, oriented like that, but you can't have this or you can't have that, for example. And so I tried to draw this graphically. There's a particle called a pion which happens to decay into two photons, and when it does, it will decay if the V is representing the velocity of the photon, so the photons are going back to back apart. And then the orientedness, the orientation of the photons are given by this other little arrow. So they either are like this or they're like that, but you can't have a different combination. And so then the question is, basically, you can have this photon go, you know, 100 kilometers, and then someone can detect it, and when they do, you know what this other one has to be because of this correlated nature. You have a question?
Yeah, what is orientation?
Orientation... orientation basically means a direction aspect to it. You could imagine having a basketball that spins like this, and we could define that as being this direction, or the basketball could spin like that, which we could define as that direction. So if we start out with, you know, two basketballs being formed, they either come out with spins like that or spins like that, but you can't have them do this or you can't have them do that. So that's basically the idea. And so in quantum mechanics, we don't actually know when the process starts which case we've got, and there's a 50% probability of either one happening, which means when you're mathematically modeling this, you have to model it basically as a state of 50% of one plus 50% of the other. And the state is actually ill-defined. You don't really know whether you have this or that until you measure one of the photons, okay? So if you measure this one, for example, and find out it's like this, then you know this one will have to be like that. And if you measure and find this one like this, then the other one will be like that, okay? Now, the question came up last time about, well, what's weird about this? Because at inception, basically, the choice of this or that could happen. And that turns out not to be the case. This superposition state of this and or that sort of actually is the case until observation is made. Now, it's not completely obvious, well, it's certainly not obvious why that has to be the case, and it's a little subtle, and I'm not going to waste a lot of time with it, but I did want to point out that in Hobson, there is a discussion of this. Basically, there are experiments that you can do which will show that you have the superposition state until you resolve one of the photons, so an actual measurement is made. And the example that Hobson gives is, suppose you have a situation where you have a source of photons that come out in a correlated way, you know, and you then put the two photons through double slits. And you know what happens when light goes through a double slit, you get an interference pattern. And if these two things were completely unrelated once formed, you should get a standard interference pattern here and a standard interference pattern here, and there should be no real correlation between the two. It turns out that that in fact there is a pattern that you get over here which is correlated to the pattern that you get over here. In other words, there's an association between them, which basically tells you that even though these photons are going through these slits, that, see, the thing is, once the photons go through the slits, remember, you still don't know where the photon is until it actually hits and is detected on the screen. And you can set up the experiment to show that that when this one is detected, remember, it is in some pattern of interference fringes, and you don't know where it'll actually show until it's detected. When this one is detected, there's a correlation in the pattern over here from that photon, because these things exist in this quantum state where they're correlated, they're sort of mixed together, even though this distance can be large. I mean, hundreds of kilometers, for example. People have done experiments, according to Hobson, where this distance has been over hundreds of kilometers. It's an active area of research, and but the existence of these entangled states is very well established. The experiments are not so trivial to understand or explain, in my mind. So we have this weird situation where the quantum state can exist over large distance and has a certain degree of indeterminism, but when you freeze a piece of it, you've frozen it all. And so this leads to sort of two extreme ways of looking at the problem, both of which actually work in terms of calculations, but both of which have very different problems in terms of conceptual understanding. So one of them we call the Copenhagen interpretation, and this would be pretty much the one that came out in the 1920s and 30s and was led by Niels Bohr was certainly a big proponent. In this picture, the wave function, the psi that we've talked about in quantum mechanics, the square of it actually gives you the probability of finding the particle. And you can sort of imagine that the wave function contains within it that information about probability. And until you actually make a measurement, that wave function has to maintain the full extent of all the possibilities. But the moment a measurement is made, the wave function is said to collapse instantaneously into from all of these possibilities to that one certainty that you've got. And the problem with that conceptually is that collapse happens over potentially large distances instantly, which is very bothersome and basically makes it seem, physicists say it's non-local, and it can seem acausal. It can seem as if the cause and effect is sort of destroyed, because you're basically, it seems as if you're transmitting information instantaneously across space. So true Copenhagenists don't get so bothered by this, because what they say is, look, this whole wave function crap is a little bit like a tool we use to calculate things. The reality is you don't know anything until you actually make a measurement. So you shouldn't be bothered by the fact that you have this extended thing that collapses, because truthfully, you know nothing about the extended thing. The only thing you ever know is what you measure. And so that's sort of how they try to get around that problem. Okay? I have to confess that was the picture that I learned in graduate school. And if you were bothered by it, it was a little bit like, generally, except for unless you really were hung up on those things, it was a little bit, well, shut up and calculate. You know, it doesn't matter. It works, right? So just go do it. It's a little distasteful. So let's look at the other extreme. The other extreme is that when a quantum process happens, you don't think of the wave function as encompassing just that one little process. You think of the wave function as actually encompassing the entire universe. And when a quantum process happens, all possibilities within the larger wave function actually happen, which means when this particles decay, when it decays, for example, in the entangled photons we were talking about, within the overall wave function, this happens and that happens. And so along one thread of reality, you'll measure this, and the other thread, you'll measure that, and they both happen with basically a 50-50 probability within this larger wave function. And then the problem is, well, how come we don't see this other possibility? And within the quantum mechanical calculations, you do it in what we call Hilbert space, which involves all of the possibilities within the calculation. So it would be the position and momentum of each of the photons and all of the other things that they may interact with or be part of the problem. And this makes it a much mathematically many, many more dimensions than we're sort of used to thinking about if we just try to picture a three-dimensional space plus time. And so things that are separated amongst those other dimensions basically are not things we can observe. So it's a little bit weird, but that's the basic idea, is that when a quantum mechanical process happens, it sort of defines a number of different threads in reality, and you can think of these different emergent threads in the reality of this larger wave function. We often will call them sort of parallel universes. I mean, I guess that's a way to think about it. So this is one of the multiverse pictures. It's probably the one that is most prevalent in science fiction and things like that. One of the problems with many worlds is that legitimate quantum mechanical states are these actual superposition states, that you can have strange states where this and that, a perfectly good quantum mechanical state would be half this and half that, as a way to think about it. And we don't see those states. And the reason we don't see those states is that if a quantum mechanical system interacts with any other particles in the environment, it will become entangled quantum mechanically, so it will actually create other states. So you can have this with some other particle doing that, or you can have that with some other particle doing this, and so that's two separate states. And other lots of other possibilities. So whatever it interacts with, you get quantum mechanical entanglement, and that effectively takes the probability of this strange state and sort of diffuses it within Hilbert space, so that very quickly after it's formed, the probability of ever observing it goes to zero, and so this, or converges towards zero, and so this happens really fast, on the order of 10 to the minus 27 seconds. So it's not that it doesn't exist. People have created superposition states in the lab that have lasted longer, and they've done experiments and where they've actually shown that what the superposition can last longer, but basically the way they've done that is to isolate the system from the environment and so far as they possibly could. So there's some very strange stuff in quantum mechanics that doesn't make a lot of sense necessarily. There are different ways of looking at it. The Copenhagen idea sort of tries to maintain as much of a classical sense of looking at it as possible. The Many Worlds comes from Hugh Everett in 1957 and has evolved with the idea of decoherence since then. And I don't know if it's fair to say many worlds is taking over in the world of physics, but certainly I think it's got a level of legitimacy now that I don't think I sensed when I was in graduate school, in a sense. So, okay. Do you have any questions about that? I mean, it is strange stuff, I know. So I wanted to follow up on this just a little bit. There's a different multiverse that I throw out there in the taxonomy that I introduced at the start of the class, which I call the multiverse of wishful thinking. And it's a very bizarre thing. Have any of you read The Secret? Yeah? Okay. It's like a massive bestseller book, right? I mean, it's, yeah, and there's a movie. So, this stuff, as weird as it is an interpretation of quantum mechanics that is scientifically supported. People are running tests on it. It holds water, okay? There is no evidence that refutes the idea that you can have these different threads of reality. That holds water. Now, that's not to say we can necessarily prove this exists, but the overall formalism of quantum mechanics basically has it within it, and quantum mechanics is very well supported scientifically. So, as bizarre as it may seem, there is a way of interpreting quantum mechanics where for every quantum mechanical process you have these different emergent threads of reality as if you create parallel universes at that moment, and that where all of the quantum mechanical possibilities are allowed. You can sort of mix these two up, which I believe is the foundation of what I'm about describing, the multiverse of wishful thinking. One of the things that comes out of Copenhagen is that, it's true with both of these, the observer and the thing that is observed are really not separate in quantum mechanics. Because you have to observe it somehow. And this wave function will not collapse until something interferes with it. So something basically makes an observation or causes it to collapse. So the observer gets tied into the system. So people have pondered whether the brain or the observer actually plays a very important role in quantum mechanics happening. And in a sense, does your consciousness cause wave function collapse along certain threads? Is your conscious awareness of the event the thing that causes the wave function to collapse, perhaps, is a way to look at it. So this is an idea that has been out there that people have talked about for a long time. If you couple that with the idea of these emergent threads of reality and that may exist in the larger wave function, and you sort of mix the two ideas up, which bothers me because these are really very different interpretations of quantum mechanics that are basically contradictory. But if you'll just bear with me for a minute, suppose that you argue that the brain is an important part, or the awareness is an important part of collapsing the wave function, and then you argue that there are threads of possibilities amongst which you can collapse it. Then comes the idea that perhaps through careful focused thinking and wishing with your brain, you can sort of collapse your reality to go along the thread of reality which you would like it to be. So this is sort of the idea that is tossed out there in this book, The Secret, and in this movie, What the Bleep Do We Know? They talk about, in The Secret, it's very much about the law of attraction, they call it. And the idea in the law of attraction is if you want something, you picture yourself with that something, you believe in it, you convince yourself basically that this is the way it's going to be, and the universe will effectively deliver it to you. It is argued that it comes from quantum mechanics in the book and the movie. And What the Bleep Do We Know, it's sort of a similar thing. The connection really isn't painted. So as near as I can figure, the idea is that it is the connection of the conscious brain with the universal wave function that causes this collapse amongst the things that you want it to be. Now, I call it the multiverse of wishful thinking. And I throw it in here because it is something that you'll actually see out there. This is a massive bestseller, as I say, and I actually put it in the multiverse taxonomy when a friend of mine who had read The Secret told me that she was learning about quantum mechanics, that this was supported by quantum mechanics. And I realized that that maybe we should talk about this, because the thing is, I'm all for the power of positive thinking, and I don't think we know everything, and I think there's some interesting things to talk about with that, but there is nothing in quantum mechanics that supports this idea of the law of attraction. There's nothing in the science that says that this is the case. You can scientifically talk about the possibility of conscious thought and quantum mechanics, and there are people who do. There's a guy named Roger Penrose in particular, has published several books on it. But we have to think about it a little bit. Thought is either married to the physical processes happening in your brain, or it's not. Okay? Now, I think scientifically, you argue that it is. If you argue that thought is independent of your brain, that the mind has some reality that has nothing to do with your actual physical brain, then you're immediately outside the realm of science as I know it, because any neurobiologist you're talking to will, there's a physical reason for a lot of this stuff. That's not to say we fully understand consciousness at this point, but there's some faith that it's tied to the physical reality of what's happening in your brain. If you argue that it's tied to the reality of what's happening in the brain only works so fast. It's tied to chemistry, and chemical processes, we know how fast those things happen. So you can't have a conscious thought. Even a very flighty person has a conscious thought. It happens over seconds. But even if you say a chemical process happens in the brain, that's governed by the speed with which those processes can happen in the brain, which is understood. Yeah.
When you're talking about the wave function collapsing, can you just explain a little more?
Yeah. So the picture I use is, let's say you have a particle headed through a double slit. Or it could even be, we can even make it a single slit for simplicity. What we know is that if we send a million particles through this slit individually and we record where they're detected, the probability of them being detected, basically, they'll get diffracted, so they'll come out, spreading out, and the probability of detecting them, if the probability increases this way, will be some distribution like this, okay? And an individual photon coming through, or particle coming through, you don't know whether it'll hit here or here or here. All I know is if I send a million of them through, I'll most likely get most of them right here, but I'll see often things out to these other sides with the probability distribution that's given like that. So what I mean by wave function and wave function collapse is if I try to model this process for that particle going through this little slit, because it's a wave, I don't know where it will show up individually, which means in the mathematical model, right up until the time it hits the detector, I have to preserve the possibility that it could happen anywhere along where this thing, spread out thing, could be. Which means the wave function, which is the mathematical thing describing that particle in the mathematics, has to sort of, in a sense, be mathematically spread out. The instant that particle is detected, mathematically that collapses into a spike of probability right where it got detected, a probability of 1. And so we call that wave function collapse. So it's this discontinuity between the situation where you preserve all the possibilities to the situation where you have an observed thing. And there's always going to be a discontinuity there because there's not a one-to-one correspondence between what you actually measure and what all the possibilities could be. So it's some form of uncertainty that is inherent in quantum mechanics that we don't have in Newtonian physics. So if the brain is tied to physical reality of chemical and electrochemical processes, we know the speed with which those happen, and those tend to happen fairly slow on the scale of quantum mechanical decoherence. So a way to think about quantum mechanical processes, selections being made within the emergent threads in Hilbert space for the different realities that can have the parallel universes if you have a quantum mechanical process, we know that that kind of selection happens on the order of 10 to the minus 27, minus 20th seconds, because those are experiments that we have. And it takes a very special situation to set it up so that the environment is isolated enough that you can have the decoherence process, the quantum mechanical process, happen much slower than that. Which means the typical quantum mechanical process selection happens on a timescale which is vastly faster than your brain actually operates. So the idea that the conscious brain, if it's tied to the electrochemical reality of what we have, I think just makes no sense. That just doesn't really work. If you argue that there is mind outside of the electrochemical brain, I think you're sort of outside the scientific realm as far as I understand it as is, and I'm not sure how much sense it talks. I mean, I can't argue against it because you're now sort of outside the realm of possibilities. So to me, if you watch this movie where they basically say that the universe as we know it is all because of our brain basically observing it, I sort of have a really hard time swallowing that. So I think that is basically crap. The secret, as it's sold, the law of attraction has actually been around. I think it was around before quantum mechanics ever came out. But certainly they're now claiming to have quantum mechanical basis to it. I just don't see how that could be. People do believe it. A lot of people are interested in it because, I mean, the book has sold lots of copies. So I throw it in here. To me, it's like a faith-based thing. You could believe in that if you want. I think there are examples where the power of positive thinking has very real effects, and I actually think of that as very different from the idea of the law of attraction. I mean, there are scientifically supported studies that show the power of positive thinking can actually help in terms of physiology and, you know, help you recover faster and things like this. And there are scientific studies that show that that's the case. I think that do practice the idea of visualizing positive things that you want to happen, you can make yourself more receptive to having those happen. You can conduct yourself in a way that may actually help these things happen. So I don't think the idea of positive thinking is not a good idea. I think it actually is. But I don't think you can tie that in with quantum mechanics and talk about these emergent threads of reality sort of condensing around your ideas because of that. So that's a multiverse that I throw in there, which probably isn't typically thought of as a multiverse, but it sort of fits our definition, and I thought it would be fun to bring it up. Any comments, thoughts?
What would make that a multiverse? Because it seems to me like it would be part of this.
They have it tied in. I mean, to me, the idea that this is espousing, they tie it in with quantum mechanics. And so within quantum mechanics, you have these parallel realities of all the quantum possibilities. And so the basic idea that they're pushing is that somehow within your conscious thought, you can more or less pick which of these realities you go into. So somehow, by focusing all of your positive energy into thinking about it a certain way, yeah, you will collapse the wave function for you along one of these particular paths.
So it's the fact that you have all these potential paths that make them kind of,
yeah,
potential multiverses.
And somehow your brain is helping to select which one you go into. So it does get tied with the many worlds. But I actually think, I'm not sure that basically to make it work, the whole idea of a collapsing wave function only makes sense in the Copenhagen point of view. You never collapse the wave function in many worlds. The wave function continues to evolve with all of these possibilities. So how your mind gets you to think, put yourself into one of these, even if your mind, I mean, this whole idea of collapsing the wave function and the observer doing it just doesn't make any sense in many worlds because everything just happens. So I'm not quite sure. I think that even if you believe the mind could have an effect, I believe that the argument they have has logical inconsistencies because of the different points of view. So
could you also probably argue like hindsight biases? You know, like, I don't know. It's like you want something really badly and you end up getting it, and then
you think of the, yeah,
I wanted it really badly, so.
Probably. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. Well, there's an element of that. Yeah. Okay. Are we okay with that? All right. So I've talked a bit about some quantum weirdness. There's more to it than that. There is a degree of uncertainty in quantum mechanics which is much more integral, well, which is as integral in the theory as what we've been talking about with this whole wave function idea. And this is known as the uncertainty principle. Or sometimes it's known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It turns out that in quantum mechanics, for certain pairs of variables, you cannot know them both as precisely as possible. Let me see if I can say it a different way. You can't know everything about a particle because of its wave nature. So, for example, the uncertainty in the position of a particle times the uncertainty in the momentum of a particle. So you can think of momentum basically as its speed, if you want. Is greater than or equal to h over 2 pi. Remember, h is a small number. that's fixed. It's a particular number. I can tell you what it is. Okay, you can look it up in a table. So this turns out to be a very fundamental relationship in quantum mechanical calculations, and it has dramatic implications. This is the uncertainty in the position. This is the uncertainty in the momentum. If I measure extremely well where a particle is, okay, this combination of two things has to be greater than some little number. So if I measure this to be really small, the uncertainty is really small, it means I know exactly where that particle is, then this number has to be big, because together they have to multiply and be bigger than this particular number. Yeah?
I have two questions. One,
yeah.
How is the uncertainty quantified? Like, I don't know, what units is uncertainty?
Is it percentage?
It could be size, okay. What is your certainty about where the electron is in an atom? Well, what we know from the quantum mechanical calculations is you see these maps, these sort of orbitals, and you cannot know where the electron is within those orbitals, but those orbitals tend to be about within 10 to the minus 10 meters of the nucleus. So you could argue that your uncertainty in the position of where that nucleus is around 10 to the minus 10 meters. So that's an idea of how you can do it. Okay, so it depends on what you're measuring. So every particular thing you talk about, you'd have to think about how well you're doing, how well you localize it.
Like percentage, then?
Well, you could think of it as percentage of something, but I mean, I'm talking about an absolute measurement. So you can put it in units of meters, you know, 10 to the minus 10 meters. If you wanted to know where someone is in this room and you were outside the room but you knew they were in this room, you would have an uncertainty of what is this 15 meters by 15 meters, right? If you're outside the room, that's about as good as you can get. So that would be your measurement of the uncertainty of where they are.
Is the size of the object that you were in question relevant? Obviously, like,
yeah, it can be.
My pencil can be in a lot more places in this room because it's smaller than my body. So would that factor into the uncertainty?
Maybe a little bit, but I mean those two. Yeah, if you wanted the two, it could. But more or less, your body can be anywhere pretty much that your pen could be. I mean, just slightly different because your pen can get closer to the edge of the wall than your body can. So, yeah, the uncertainty for your pen would be slightly larger than. So what this says is, if I know exactly where something is, I don't know its momentum that well. Which means I don't necessarily know its speed, if you want to think of it that way. If I know its momentum really well, then I don't really know where it is. And this actually has to do with the wave-like nature of things. There's a way in which I could make this make sense if you... physics-wise, which I think I'm not going to waste my time with you guys right now, because I don't think it worked too well. So a way to think about this is okay, so maybe this sounds fine. You've probably heard of the uncertainty principle, and so who cares? Let's think about it this way. Well, we'll come back to that. So let's think about what this means classically. So if I have a car, for example, and I want to know how this car is moving, I can take a radar gun or a laser, right, and I can bounce light off of it, and I can bounce light off of it here and then light off of it here, and based on the distance between those two reflections, I can calculate the speed, and based on where I get the reflections, I can calculate its position. And so in Newtonian physics, there's no limit to how well I can do that. If if I do the same thing with an electron, so let's say I have a little electron here, and I decide I want to know where it is and how fast it's moving, and how might you do that? Well, you could play the game of trying to bounce a photon off of it too. But the problem is, if you bounce a photon off of an electron, because the electron is very small, you more or less blast the electron. You change its momentum when you bounce a photon off of it. It would be like figuring out where the car is by bouncing a Volvo off of it. Right? That doesn't work the same as the light. The light that you bounce off a car won't affect the car's motion at all. But if you were to hit it with a Volvo, it will. So you might figure out where it is by where the Volvo gets bounced off, but you're not going to any longer know the momentum of the car. Okay? So that's what happens with the electron. In the world of the very small, there's inherently a limitation to figuring out where something is and its momentum simultaneously to infinitely good precision. So this is to first order, which is, I guess, a physics way of saying things, sorry. This is sort of, to a first approximation, just a mental game, okay? Because there is a fundamental limitation to this. Remember, in Newtonian physics, there's the whole idea that if I can tell you the position of every particle in the universe and the speed with which it's going and tell you what forces are on it, I can calculate the future of the universe. Right? There's nothing to prevent me from knowing that. If I have a system of particles and I know that information about all those particles, if I have a powerful enough computer, I can calculate what will happen to that system infinitely far in the future. And Newtonian physics works really well with this, right? I can launch a projectile from a ship and calculate exactly where it's going to hit with some small imprecisions. But if I really know the forces well enough, I can hit an ant from 20 miles. Okay? So our whole world is built around this idea. This is why airplanes fly and bridges stand, because this is how we think about it. Okay? What quantum mechanics is now telling us is that I can have a system, could be the universe, could be a small box of particles. I can't even know the position and the velocity of those particles to infinite precision, much less calculate how it evolves, because if I know the positions really well, I don't know the velocities really well, which means there's uncertainty inherent in the motion from that point on. So quantum mechanics has built within it basically an uncertainty, which means this whole idea of the deterministic universe that comes out of Newton has just gotten thrown out the window. The universe has within it fundamentally indeterminism that we cannot beat. So that's what quantum mechanics says. You look bothered. Good. All right. You with me on that so far? So that's known as the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, and it is a very fundamental limitation of things. Now, yes?
Doesn't Schrodinger's equation kind of help limit that uncertainty?
No, it's implicit. It's all part of the same package. There's nothing you can do to beat this uncertainty. And it is part and parcel of Schrodinger's equation and the mathematics of quantum mechanics and the wave-like nature of things. It actually comes out of, when you think of particles, instead of being particles, you allow them to be waves. This uncertainty basically is implicit. We do have a similar sort of thing in the classical world of waves. One way to think about, where is the wave hitting the beach? You know, what does it mean? Where is it? Turns out, if you have a narrow, you can construct a narrow wave arbitrarily out of waves of different frequencies, waves of different wavelengths. And mathematically, that's how you would model a very sharp wave, where you would know its position very well. But mathematically, in order to get that to work, you actually are creating that mathematical model out of many different waves of different frequencies and adding them together, and that's known as Fourier analysis. And so what that means, if I know where the wave is, I actually don't know what its frequency is very well, and vice versa. So classically, we do actually have this sort of thing, but why it sort of becomes important in terms of the world of material particles is because we're actually now thinking of them as waves instead of particles, and we get stuck with that limitation. But it's an integral part of the theory. So, the implication of this, just to start with, is that we've just lost the deterministic universe, which is sort of bothersome in a sense if you're a science geek. But it actually gets much worse than that. Or perhaps it's very liberating, depending on how you look at it. Within the quantum mechanics and mathematics, there are pairs of variables where this kind of uncertainty relationship happens to be true, one of which is momentum and position. There's another, which is energy and time. And this one is a weird one that opens up a whole can of worms for us. So you can think of this as the time over which something exists. And the way I want to talk about it. So suppose what this really says is that I can break conservation of energy so long as I do it over such a short time that you can't measure it. It doesn't really break conservation of energy because it has to be consistent with this rule, which is allowed in quantum mechanics. But if I have something that only exists for a really, really, really short time, the uncertainty in the time, that delta T, is very small, which means, according to this, our knowledge of the energy is inherently limited, and the energy could be any of a large number of possibilities because of how uncertain it is. Okay? So I can make a Volvo appear here out of thin air, breaking conservation of energy, so long as I do it over such a short time, you'd never know it. And it sounds sort of Harry Potterish, and it is. Okay? But it also works with quantum mechanics, and there's some massive implications to this. Yes.
I could be completely wrong, but is that saying like if something happens so fast and no one can sense it that it didn't happen?
Tree falls in the woods and nobody hears it, make a sound.
Well, I mean, it's not quite that example, but it's like the tree could appear and then disappear, and so long as it happens so fast you can't observe it, you're okay. But it's not just, you can't observe it. There actually has to quantitatively satisfy this. Okay.
But like, you know how they do kind of like subconscious priming experiments in psychology where they'll flash something on the screen that's in, you can't perceive because it's just milliseconds. And it's still intentionally do it. I mean, there's still, I mean, are you, It's obviously still there, even though you're not consciously perceiving.
Yeah. Okay. So I don't know how this ties in with those experiments. I mean, there are some similarities to what we're talking about. Yes.
Does this kind of tie in with like super colliders and being able to create?
That's right where we're headed.
Okay.
Yep. Next words out of my mouth. This sounds pretty wacky, okay? And at some level, you go, well, what do I care? Because obviously, who cares if I can make a Volvo appear there if it has to disappear so fast you'd never know it, right? That's sort of an irrelevant thing. Where it becomes important is in the mathematics of how we actually calculate things in quantum mechanics. So let us suppose that you want to describe an electron bebopping through the vacuum, for example. Okay? So there's the electron, and it's just going along through a vacuum. How do you describe this electron? What is allowed, the uncertainty principle that I just described means that there are all sorts of possibilities that this electron could have in terms of its being that could not exist without this. So let me give you an example. We could have this electron moving along and it could emit a photon, effectively breaking conservation of energy. And so long as that photon comes back and rejoins the electron, in a very short time, such that this uncertainty principle is satisfied, this is a perfectly legitimate possibility. And if you were to calculate any characteristic of this electron, you would have to calculate not only this as one of the possibilities, but also this. Well, it doesn't stop there. Instead of just having that, we could have, for example, that electron going along. It could emit a photon. That photon could pair produce into an electron and a positron, and then it could all come back. And so long as it's a positive electron, it's an anti-particle, we're going to get there. You can have particles that are just like our particles but have opposite electric charge, which we call antimatter, and this is very real stuff, and we do make them in the lab all the time. But, yeah. So, sorry.
So everything we see and we know that we're familiar with are positrons, right?
Yeah. They don't exist typically in matter, because if I had a positron right here, we could observe it for a moment, but if it touches an electron, they would annihilate into gamma rays. So you don't typically have antimatter out. And one of the great mysteries that, in fact, many people I know, including my scientific program, is aimed at trying to find is to try to understand why the universe is matter versus antimatter. There's an asymmetry there that we're trying to understand. We'll get there, so just be patient with that. But the idea is that the photon can turn into an electron and its antiparticle, and it can come back together into a photon, and that photon can come back to that electron, and that's a legitimate possibility that, again, would break conservation of energy if I just summed up all these masses and everything at that one instant. But you can effectively do this if you do it over a short enough time. That means I can't observe these particles because they might fleetingly exist and then they have to come back. So you might say, well, why do I care? Why I care is if I'm mathematically trying to understand the electron, I have to sum up all of these possibilities, anything that could possibly happen. And it means all of these strange possibilities could happen. I could have something as complicated as this and vastly more complicated. And if I wanted to calculate something about electrons, I have to sum over all of these quantum mechanical possibilities. There's a field of physics which basically does this type of calculation, which is known as quantum field theory. And this turns out to be the quantum mechanical explanation to the nature of forces and all particle characteristics. And it works because it takes into account all of these possibilities from Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So initially this whole idea sounds sort of academic and ridiculous to even talk about. I can break conservation of energy as long as I can do it in such a way you can never notice it. The thing is, if you want to do the quantum mechanical calculation, all of those possibilities come into the calculation and they affect it. So, and this has been known for a long time. You probably heard of Richard Feynman. I mean, one of the things he did that got a Nobel Prize for was learning how to do these types of calculations for electromagnetism, for example. So how this gets tied in with the whole concept of force is the modern view of forces in quantum mechanics comes in the following way. These possibilities you cannot see, right? These particles could happen, but it all has to come back together before you can make an observation. But all of these possibilities could, in principle, happen. So you can no longer think of this particle as zipping, as a BB going through the vacuum. You sort of have to think of it as a cloud of virtual possibilities. So you can imagine that at any given moment, if you could freeze time, you would find one of these strange pictures or something vastly more complex actually happening. It isn't just an electron. It is a bunch of photons and electrons as possibilities or other particles or whatever. And we call those virtual, we call those particles that could have an existence in principle because of the uncertainty principle, we call them virtual particles. They're not real because you can't actually see them because they have to go back into nothing before you could ever observe them. But if you're doing the mathematical calculation, you have to take them into account, these virtual particles, these virtual possibilities. So if we take the force of electromagnetism and ask, what is the fundamental essence of that force in quantum mechanics? And in fact, Richard Feynman was basically one of the ones who gave us this. Suppose I have two electrons moving along near each other. Each of these electrons, you can imagine, is a cloud of virtual possibilities. So one of them might have this happening like that, and another might be like this. Okay? Suppose that, in fact, they exchange a virtual particle. So one of the virtual particles for this particle actually ends up with the other particle. If I'm mathematically modeling the electron to be one of these possibilities, I have to conserve charge, I have to conserve momentum and everything, which means, for example, if I were to sum up the charges here, I have to have the minus sign. So this would be the minus plus minus. Here, I guess it also works. So the virtual particles carry within them the net characteristics of that electron, like its momentum. They carry the energy, they carry charge, okay? Which means this photon, this virtual photon, can be absorbed by this one relative to that one. It can actually carry momentum and energy. If I convey momentum and energy from one thing to another, that's actually how you define a force. It's called an exchange force. Imagine two people on ice and you have a big exercise ball, right? If I throw the exercise ball to somebody, right? When I do this, it pushes me back. When they catch it, it pushes them back. By exchanging that particle, we actually exchange momentum. And that's what you mean by a force. That's a repulsive force. Okay? So this is the essence of a force. I mean, earlier when we talked about forces, we sort of just had forces at a distance, and we sort of pulled out of thin air this idea of the field. here is the quantum mechanical idea of a force. It's an actual exchange of a virtual particle. The nature of the force is determined by the characteristics of the actual particle that's exchanged. So in the case of electromagnetism, the particle that gets exchanged is the photon. In the case of other forces, it'll be other particles, which I'll talk about at another time. Yeah.
What's it exchanged between the photon?
You would calculate it as an exchange between the two fundamental electrons.
Okay. Is that a medium, I guess? Is it like a medium for the...
Is there a medium for it?
Are the electrons the medium for the field?
The field is in the vacuum. I mean, the photon is in the vacuum, and the electrons happen to be in the vacuum, and it's the exchange of that photon between the electrons that causes the force between the electrons. So if you're going to model the electromagnetic force, that's the picture you use.
Okay. So if there are no electrons in the vacuum, but just photons, is there an electromagnetic force?
Yeah. That's a good question. So let's talk about the vacuum for a moment. Because this changes everything. Let's suppose I have a box of vacuum. What does that mean? What's in that box? Nothing. Right? That's what you mean. Okay. Can I have that anymore? Let's look at a little place in this vacuum. What do I know? I know if I look at it over a short enough time, my knowledge of the energy at that point in space is very uncertain. If I have a large enough energy at that point, which I could in principle have over a short enough time, I can have enough energy there that basically I could create particle and antiparticle pairs of particles. We call it quantum fluctuations. So you can actually have in the vacuum, if you go looking at it carefully, pairs of particles that just pop out of nothing and go back to nothing. That is allowed by quantum mechanics. Okay? And they could be electrons and positrons or other types of particles like quarks and antiquarks or whatever. It doesn't matter. You have to conserve charge, which is sort of why antiparticles have to exist. But so in this picture, we no longer have a vacuum that is truly empty. Because we allow these quantum mechanical fluctuations to happen, you have to think of the vacuum as a seething sea of particles and antiparticle pairs popping in and out of nothing. And that's what you really mean when you talk about quantum fluctuations in energy. It's this basic idea that over a short enough time, your knowledge of the energy at any given point in that point in space is uncertain at a level. You can even have particles. So what this means is if I fire a particle through a vacuum, it actually will interact with these strange little pairs that pop in and out. They may not be there for very long, but if this other particle is going through, it will actually interact with them a little bit. And we experimentally can go out and find evidence for that. I mean, this is not crap. This is very well supported experimental stuff. So it's a very strange new vision on the world. It's very liberating because now all of a sudden, in a sense, we can sort of break energy conservation if you sort of do it within Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. I mean, the constraints of that, yes.
But it is... So then are the electron, the positive and negative electrons, do they act as a medium? Does the light need that uncertainty in order to travel through? Like, say if there were a vacuum and, you know, though we are uncertain, obviously it's just kind of, you know, doesn't really make a lot of sense because if we're uncertain, we can never know. But if there were a vacuum that didn't have anything pop up and light were to travel through it.
It would be different than it is if you have one where things can pop up.
Would there be an electron?
So there is, for example, an inertia formed by the interaction of particles with these virtual particles in the vacuum. And that is in fact one way of talking about mass, the essence of mass. I mean, so the effect is there. You can actually calculate observable effects due to these virtual particles existing. It's fairly small because they're not there very long, and you know.
So
yes.
After the fact, one would be able to know what did pop up, like in a given time, you know, like in a vacuum, you know, what combinations and where.
No, you'd never be able to get it to that level. You could have a picture of all the possibilities in a vacuum, and then send, you know, then calculate what the effect might be on a system due to the net sum of all the possible effects that could happen, and you might come up with something that's observable. That kind of thing people have seen. So they've actually seen, for example, shifts in spectral lines in atoms that come from effects from the vacuum. So the vacuum is no longer nothing in physics. It is something that basically has some reality to it, some structure. Yes?
So, like, where did these virtual particles come from, and where did they go?
They come out of nothing and go back into nothing. So they come out of the vacuum and go back into the vacuum. Energy and mass have an equivalence. So if I have energy of a certain magnitude, it could just change into the mass because they're basically the same. And if I tell you that within this part of space I have an uncertainty in the energy that is so great, then in principle I could have that energy take any form that it can possibly do, which means if that uncertainty is large enough, it could be massive particles with opposite charge. That is a possibility. You cannot see them directly because if that's not allowed by Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Basically, it happens over such a short time. But if you truly want to calculate the effect of the vacuum on something or what could be happening in the vacuum, that possibility is one of the possibilities you have to consider. Because remember, quantum mechanics is all about the possibilities. That's the thing that you can know, is the probability distribution. So anything that could happen, you have to know, you have to put into this calculation. So that's sort of where this becomes real, in a sense. It becomes part of this calculation. It turns out that it can have observable consequences to the things that we actually see. So this this is something that I think of as very real, as weird as it may sound. And I have to drag you through it because, we're going to start talking about particle physics and cosmology and how these things tie together. This becomes a very important piece of the whole picture. You get a little bit used to it. I know it's a little bit strange. Okay, it's a lot strange. We have a theory which we call the standard model of particle physics that describes to a gnat's eyebrow phenomenon that happen with the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic forces of nature. Details like I can take a beam of particles and bash them into a target, and this thing can calculate the exact angular distribution and the way the particles will scatter off one another to a T. Okay, I mean, this theory works really well. It is totally built on this weird picture. So scientifically, this really is, this is the paradigm. So we're just beginning to get into that. Okay, so what I wanted to do next is to actually start the venture into what I call inner space. And which means what I'd like to do, because we've been talking a bit about atoms, and now we've talked a bit about quantum mechanics, and now I wanted to start probing into the structure of matter, into the very small, which means I want to go from atoms into the structure of nuclei and how all this ties together. So we're going to actually do talk about nuclear physics Thursday and next Tuesday, which sadly is sort of very timely right now because of the stuff that's going down in Japan. I'm sorry, Wednesday. Yeah. Don't mind me. It's 1 a.m. for me. So we're going to talk about nuclear physics, and I'm not going to have time to do a lot on it, but I did want to do at least one thing. The word is nuclear, and I have a bit of a pet peeve. It just scares the crap out of me when we have a president that pronounces it nuclear. Just if you get anything out of this class, it's nuclear. Yes.
I've been taking linguistics recently, and I just wanted to point out that it's kind of arbitrary, and a lot of words are pronounced differently by different people.
Yeah, but this one really bothers me. It really does. Okay, so just a personal pet peeve.
How did Carter say it?
Nuclear. He's a nuclear engineer. Yeah. So that's why I had to, I mean, this is an apolitical statement, because one's a Republican, one's a Democrat. They both bothered me a great deal. For them to have their finger on the button and then pronounce the word like that bothered me a lot. Okay, so I can't get into nuclear physics quite yet, because we're going to run out of time, but I do have something I wanted to show you. So what you're about to see is, in case you are not a believer in these strange little particles and everything that I'm going to talk about, we're going to look at something. Let me just tell you what it is. There's a rod which is impregnated with a radioactive material known as thorium. And that's actually not new in your life. There's thorium all over the place. Thorium will decay naturally. It will radioactively decay. And when it does, it will produce a particle which is known as an alpha particle, and we'll talk more about this. But an alpha particle is basically two protons and two neutrons, and it has a charge of +2, so it's sort of a heavily charged particle. So when the thorium decays into an alpha particle, the alpha particle will go streaming off in whatever random direction it's going to go when the nucleus decays. When it does, we have in this particular thing, it's known as a cloud chamber. We have it set up where we have a gas that is at that is right at a temperature where it is just about ready to condense. And oddly enough, you can condense the gas if you have a charged particle passing through it. So what you will see when you look up here is there will be a rod, and if you look at it carefully, you'll actually see little wisps, linear little wisps of condensation, which will look like a little stream of a cloud, right? And that's the path of the particle going through the mist. And if you're lucky, when you're looking at it, you may actually see something going basically from up to down, and that would be a particle called a muon, a cosmic ray that's coming from an interaction in the atmosphere, which we do have streaming through us all the time, and you might see one of those here too. At any rate, if you want to come on up and see if you can see some alpha particles, I should say the alphas cannot get through this. They won't hurt you, and they wouldn't hurt you from being outside your body anyway. I wouldn't want you to grind up and chew the thorium source, but you're perfectly safe coming up here and looking. All right, so you see the rod coming here. Now just watch it for a moment, and you'll see these little wisps coming off in random directions. And those are the alpha particles.
Is that liquid in there?
It's just gas moving?
It's gas. It's at a... It's still on. I just invited them down to look at it.
What are we supposed to see?
If you look at the rod going back, that rod contains radioactive substance. And every now and then you'll see these sort of linear wisps of...
Right.
Of there's one just there.
Wisps of what?
I see.
Mist. You see the little lines of mist that form randomly in there? Because the alpha particle just decayed, the thorium just decayed, sent an alpha particle along that line, and that caused the condensation.
Alpha particle decays, and then there's...
The thorium decays, creates an alpha particle, which then causes the gas to condense along the line of the path of the alpha particle.
So this thing is thorium refers to the chemical that's on the roof.
Yeah.
And then what's the gas that's in there? That's just oxygen? Or like water vapor? I mean, that stuff that...
Yeah, it's actually probably alcohol, an alcohol mix at a certain temperature.
Thorium decays and then creates an alpha particle. That's like a mist?
The alpha particle is in the mist, but as it goes through the gas, which is basically set to rain, I mean, you know, if you were to have... the gas is just ready to condense into sort of droplets, which is what dew or mist is, right? It's like a cloud. And so what's happening is as the thorium goes through, it effectively seeds a little cloud right along where it passes. And that's the little line of mist you see, which then diffuses away.
Like the actual mist is just what's in the air. It's just the particle is just basically drawing itself.
Think of it as fog.
Yeah.
The alpha particle is the alpha particle.
The alpha particle goes zipping along, and basically it forms a fog, if you want. It causes the condensation right along its path.
So there won't, when this is done and you want to look at the glass under here, there won't be any residue?
Residue from what?
No, but what I'm saying is, like, if it were, like, raining, you know, like the rain analogy you're using, if it were raining, there'd be, like...
Oh, right. Oh, well, yeah. Well, there is. There is. There's moisture. I mean, yeah, there's... this is at a certain temperature, and let me ask Tang, what's the liquid? Tang, what's the liquid you're using in this? It's isopropyl ethyl alcohol.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's alcohol, so you there is alcohol in the bottom. So what's happening is the alcohol...
It creates alcohol?
No, it doesn't create alcohol. The alcohol is the material that's misting for you. Instead of water, water gives you fog,
it's
right?
It's missing alcohol.
Wouldn't that make it...
Well, if I have moisture-laden air, and I can create it such that the air can no longer hold that moisture very well, it will form small droplets. So those droplets are really small, we call it fog. Mm-hmm. If they're bigger, they drop and we call it rain. Okay? So the same is true here, except we're using alcohol and we basically saturate the air with the alcohol vapor. And then we put it at a temperature such that with the slightest provocation, the alcohol will condense into sort of little fog. Okay, so that provocation is the alpha particle passing through it. That ionization, that little bit of energy, actually will cause the alcohol to condense right along. And so what you see are little threads of alcohol fog, if you want.
So as the particle shoots off the rod, it's drawing bits particles of alcohol to it, creating...
Yeah, the ionization caused by the alpha particle will kick little electrons off of the atoms in the gas, and when it does, that little bit of energy deposition is enough to basically cause the alcohol to condense at that point. On the outside, that's just frozen water from the air because it's cold under there.
Yeah.
What happens to the alpha particle? Does it just drop to the ground?
Well, it might lose its energy. It might lose its energy in the air itself, because it probably will. Its range is fairly short. Eventually, it will collide into some other nucleus and lose its identity by colliding into them. But even if it went through the air, it can't get through the glass. It gets stopped by the glass. Okay. Except I don't have a pen with me. You got a pen?
This is a mid-year report for the common application.
Okay.
It needs a current grade in the class, or at least like a ballpark estimate.
Oh, gosh. Well, I don't know how to do that.
I mean, I have my exam in that.
Yeah. Right? Well, my... Okay.
Somewhere in there.
Just tell me your grade and I'll... Okay, so fine. You want me to do this whole thing? So.
Yeah, it's just a little segment there.
I
just had one short question about this first question. What exactly makes it a scientific prediction when the psychic says that?
Something that's testable.
So, if you were to wake up the next morning and everything was doubled?
If you're considering only sizes, you can't test it. Your meter stick is twice as big, your shoulders are twice as broad. Nuclei are twice as big. There's nothing in that that's testable. It's sort of a nonsensical hypothesis. It's not a scientific hypothesis because of that. If you consider things other than length and you allow things like densities to change by a factor of two, then all of a sudden you have something that's very testable. So then, yeah, so depending on...
What may be a potential... answer that
would be if I allowed densities to also double in size, and that was ambiguous by the question.
Okay.
I mean, if I take something of a certain mass and I allow the mass to double and each of its dimensions to change by a factor of two, what I actually have is I've dropped the density by a factor of four because the volume is increased by a factor of eight, two by two by two, and the mass is only increased by a factor of two, so the mass per unit volume, which is the density, will be changed by a factor of, will change. So the next day you would find your density tables would have changed, so that is very testable. So depending on how you interpreted that.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay?
Yep, thank you.
All right.
Hi.
Hey.
I need to get my exam. I was tardy last
time. Ah, okay, no problem. It is outside my office door.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yep, so you can just grab
office?
It there. It's 203E, so Bausch & Lomb, you go in right off the quad and just turn right and just keep walking past the stairwell. 203E. So if you walk past the stairwell through basically two sets of doors,
mm-hmm.
last door on your right.
Okay.
And there'll be a box just sitting in the hall that you can see. And it's all in there by folders.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. No problem.
Okay. So,
okay.
So it lasts about an hour and 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's good. That worked.